Buddy, back to another episode of Stripped Raw. We're doing another group coaching session, and today we're blessed with our first Marine. Hoorah, Marine. We got Preston here. Preston has a pretty impressive story, good track record. He's got a lot of things going for him, but he also failed in the past just like the rest of us. But he overcame his things, and that's what we're going to dissect today. Today's mail, through the lens of a bunch of military veterans, dads, husbands, here today with Fred. The beautiful Fred, as always. Fred and I go way back. Many of you know, 20 years. My son likes to wrestle with him, and my son typically wins. Do you let him win?
That's good. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Also, I've got Cam here. Cam from the original. Man, I appreciate you, all of your insight, all your questions. But the man of the hour here is going to be Preston. And Preston is... This is the beautiful thing about Stripped Raw, is us tearing all of this down, back down to its roots, getting to the vulnerable side of all of this crap. Today's male under fire. There's a lot of guys. There's a lot of gals out there, too, who are hurting, who are struggling. And our goal is to get back into the trenches with them. Preston, the beautiful thing about you is, I mean, you've got 5 kids. You've got more kids than anybody at the table right now. More kids than anybody in the entire team. So, like, and we talked a minute ago, you've got a 13-year-old boy. You've got 3 boys, 2 girls. And I just want to say, like, it's an inspiration for a dad to come on here to talk about these things and to lay the heart on the line, be vulnerable. That way, not only they can learn, but, I mean, society can learn from it, too. So I'm going to hand it over to you, Marine. Send it. Give us the rundown.
Guys, once again, thanks for having me on here. I appreciate it. I hope my lighting's good enough here, but hey, we'll run with what we got.
You look beautiful. Better than
appreciate
Fred.
Appreciate it. That's all right. As long as I'm doing better than Fred, it seems like that's the gist here, right?
Gist.
Yeah, I am the standard. So.
All right. So basically, I've been thinking about like what I was going to say this past week and a half since Cam asked me to come on. And, you know, the biggest thing that I can kind of bring to the table as far as like trying to relate with people and stuff like that is, you know, I grew up in Eastern Kentucky. It was a pretty, pretty hard life. You know, I grew up poor. I was kind of neglected as a child. I really never had, like, me and my dad were best friends, but I never really had that person like telling me, hey, you probably shouldn't do that. So I learned a lot of my life through a lot of trial and error, learning the hard way. And, you know, thankfully I never had any law and I've never gotten to anything with the law. So I've never been in jail. So I can admit that's the only thing I hadn't done. But, what's that? Go ahead. Yeah.
So do you think it's better that way, that you had a hard life?
100%. You know, when people ask me, like, if you could go back in time and change anything about your life, would you? And I always tell them, no, absolutely not.
That's what I'm talking about right there.
Because, like, the struggles I went through, and this relates to a lot of people, too, and I hope you start thinking of it this way. The struggles that I went through, had I not gone through them, would I be the person I am currently? And there are some things that I wish I didn't go through, but the, you know, just to answer your question, I'm grateful I went through it because it taught me a lot about many, you know, facets of life, whether it be life in general, whether it be myself, my relationship with my wife or my girlfriends at the time, wherever the case may be. In relationship with my kids, relationship with my, you know, my peers, my neighbors, whatever the case may be, and just overall life experience that we experience. But yeah, I wouldn't change it. I would have rather, I'd rather everything be the same as it was, because, you know, I like to use mannerisms and kind of paint the picture for you, but, you know, the Grand Canyon wouldn't be so grand if it hadn't had all that carving of the layers going through. It wouldn't be that grand. And I think that's when we start off in life, we're a fresh slate. We're clean as we can be. And then we get the wrinkles in our eyes, the scars on our bodies and things like that. That's what makes us who we are.
I've seen a lot of babies, that's for sure. Here's they are, and then as time goes on, but yeah.
Yeah, my 13-year-old, man, me and him, he's like, you took a chunk of me and grew it in a lab, and want to wrestle him every day. So yeah. he's a pain in my butt, but he's a good kid. I'm teaching him a lot of things that he's going to learn the hard way. I've already accepted that he's, you know, I could talk to him until I'm blue in the face, but you know, he'll learn the hard way, just probably not as hard as I did, which I'm grateful for. I'm able to give him that kind of pass on life kind of thing. And I'm not undermining anything that, you know, I'm not going to take away from what he can experience, but you know, everybody goes through the trials and tribulations, irregardless of what anybody tells you. You know, I'm a knucklehead. I'm a hardhead too. So, but
yeah. I'm in the Marines. No offense. Calling it for what right, it is.
Yeah. They told me I could add crayons. So I was like, hey, you know what? I know how to color crayons and they taste good too. So why not?
They taste good too. So you go through it, you learn the hard way. And that was, from what I'm taking away, your dad was teaching you, you know, learn your own way.
Well, I mean, my dad, me and him were best friends, but the problem was he was too much of a friend and not enough as a father. So he was letting me get away with things that I probably shouldn't be getting away with. And, you know, he taught me things. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I love this guy till the day he took his last breath. You know, he passed away in 2014, and we'll get into that story later. But, you know, he was my best friend. He was the person I would always turn to. I'd always be able to, you know, tell him the good, bad, and the ugly. And, you know, he really didn't judge me for it. And, you know, there's a couple of times he yelled at me like, why'd you do that, you idiot, kind of thing. But nothing too crazy. But yeah, in a gist of things. Yeah.
The same thing with these guys, instead of like buddies, you know, to Pretty me, much. That's what you, buddies.
Yep.
What we need. You know, sometimes you need that dad to drop the hammer. Sometimes, you know, in a relationship, any relationship, it could be man, woman, or whatever, they need to drop the hammer. Off to the Marines.
And well, I grew up in Eastern Kentucky, and then there's a lot to unpack between the time I was like born until the time I joined the Marines. There's a whole lot of meat and potatoes in there. And then, you know, I did join the Marine Corps, and I'm not going to be one of those guys. You know, I did serve in the United States Marine Corps Infantry. I was a rifleman. I did that for 8 years, 8 months, 8 days till I got medical retirement. But I'm not going to be one of those guys. I'll tell you, you know, I was in combat, and, you know, I almost got a Purple Heart and, you know, Medal of Honor. No, I didn't do any of that. You know, I that was something I struggled with for a long time, especially after getting out. Was, you know, I never went into combat like I had been trained to. And it wasn't because I chose to, you know, the Marine Corps tells you what to do and what not to do, and, you know, how to breathe, how to all that. So I didn't really get a choice of orders. I went from my first duty station, Marine Barracks 8th and I got selected to go there. So went there for 2 years. I did over 100 funerals at Arlington, which, my dear Lord, baby Jesus, like, that was terrible. Just the mental load that puts on you. And then, from the Marine barracks, I went to 1-2 in Camp Lejeune. I did a MU deployment with them. It was a 9-month deployment. We were actually, supposed to be the responders for, the whole Benghazi incident that was going on, but they kept calling us back to the ship. So they would fly us out, come bring us back kind of thing. So it was kind of like disheartening when we found out, you know, all those guys got killed, and, you know, here we have a whole battalion of Marines ready to save them. But, you know, so anyways, that was my first deployment. It's kind of like a booze cruise, but, you know, we did some training and some stuff kicked off while we were there, but we never got to fully put boots on deck per se. And then I left that unit. I got orders down to Parris Island, South Carolina, which a lot of you may be familiar with. It's the recruit depot. I did not go down there to be a drill instructor. Heck no, no. A lot of respect for those guys, but, you know, there was a time I wanted to do it, but no. So I went down to Parris Island. I taught on the rifle range for 3 straight years. My God, I had a loaded rifle pointed at me more there than anywhere else in my life. Oh my God. That was fun. But, yeah, I went down to Parris Island for 3 years. And then after Parris Island, I got orders out to, Camp Pendleton, California. where I served with 1-4. We went on another deployment. It was another MEW. Out on that MEW, nothing much really happened. And then that's where I actually ended up getting medevaced because of a muscular condition that I currently suffer with. It spurred up and basically got me the boot out of the Marine Corps. But you know, it was a blessing and a curse all the same. But just kind of give you my military experience, and you know, there was some things that happened during that time too. But just kind of give you in a nutshell where I'm coming from with that.
But when you if we were to go back to rewind a little bit, why did you join the Marines?
Oh, to be honest with you, it was my fifth grade year. Fifth grade is when 9/11 happened for me. I just remember sitting in my—I'll never forget the teacher's name, Miss Hilton. I was sitting in my history class of all places, and you know, at that time we didn't have cell phones and all that. I mean, if you're cool enough, you had a pager, but not really. But we were sitting
really
there.
Cool. You could be like Cam. You could be in kindergarten when it happened. But please continue.
Dude, I'm showing my age. I feel old every day, man. He was in daycare. Somebody was changing his diapers, man. Whew, that's crazy. Yeah, but I was in fifth grade and 9/11 happened. And I'll never forget, like, my teacher running in and she turned on the news on the TV. And that's when the second plane hit the South Tower or whatever it was. And I just remember, like, this shock coming through my body. And you know, one of my good friends was right beside of me, and me and him just started like bawling our eyes out because we were terrified. We were scared. We didn't know what the heck was going on. And then later, as I found out what happened and stuff, you know, I kind of got in, you know, I say indoctrinated, but I got indoctrinated to wanting to cause hate and discontent and harm to those who wanted to cause hate and discontent and harm to us. So I, from that moment forward, I decided I wanted to join the military. And kind of led from there. That was kind of like the initial response to it. But, yeah, so that's what led me to join the military. It was just, I just had that kind of drive and that initiative, and I
oh,
wanted
for
to
sure.
do something different. Where I grew up, it was either you, I jokingly say this, and you know, if you're watching from where I'm from, you can understand. And if you get butthurt about it, oh, well, I'm just very truthful. I just tell it like it is. You know, I think about what I said later, but I, growing up in Eastern Kentucky, I, you know, there were a couple choices of what you could do. I mean, you could work in the healthcare field, but I wasn't wanting to be a nurse or a doctor or any of that stuff. Or you could work in the coal mines, a lot of respect for the coal miners, but you will not catch me underneath of a mountain with, you know, 28, 32 inches of space for me to crawl in. Heck no, I ain't doing it. Or I could be a coal truck driver. I could work on the railroad if I got lucky enough to get accepted for that, or I could be a drug addict. That was about my top five choices that I had there. And I knew none of those were going to be beneficial for me, just knowing who I was and everything at that time. So, but yeah, so the military came in, and I'll never forget. It's actually a funny story, but it was my junior year. I had cycled through wanting to join the Army, wanting to join the Air Force, wanting to join the Navy. And every time I went to the recruiting station, the Army and Navy and Air Force guys would always say, dude, don't go over there to those Marines, man. They're all crazy as hell and they're weirdos and all this. And so I was like, I took their advice. So I was like, I'm not going over there. And then my junior year of high school, they came in and they were telling us to take the ASVAB test. And I'm like, oh my God, what is this? You know, like, oh wait, this is one of my requirements, so I better try. So I tried, you know, I sat through and everything. I'll never forget this guy. At the time, he was Staff Sergeant Todd. I'll tell you what that means in a second, but he got up on the stage and he was wearing his dress blues and he looked sharp as shit, man. He was like, he was a stud, but he was ugly, but he looked like a stud wearing wearing that uniform. And I'll never forget walking up to him after I took my ASVAB. I walked it up and, you know, handed it to him. I said, I basically looked at him and I had a mouth on me when I was in high school and growing up in Kentucky, but I looked at him and, you know, excuse my French, but I looked at him and I said, what the fuck are you? he lost it. He started laughing. He said, what the fuck am I? He said, I'm a fucking United States Marine. And dude, right there from that moment forward, I wanted to be a Marine. There was no like, nope, I was done. That was it. Hook, line, and sucker right there. But yeah, he always told us to call him Staff Sergeant T-O-double-D. So if you're watching this, Staff Sergeant T-O-double-D, yeah. So, but yeah, that's what got me into the Marines. But yeah.
Point when you joined the Marines, what was the darkest point in your life? And how does that compare to the darkest point in your life after you joined the Marines to now?
Man, so
Good question.
this point
Assuming
prior to the
before the
Marines,
Marines,
yeah,
before the Marines, you were a boy.
I
Wouldn't
would
be called a boy anymore after that, even if you acted like one.
so I had to grow up at an early age. I just to kind of give you a synopsis of what happened, but you know, at 4 years old, that was my first, you know, kiss with death, or whatever you want to call it, flirt with death. But I was 4 years old, and you know, if you've ever seen somebody on an ATV or four wheeler, whatever you call it, do a 3-point turn, you know, you pull up a side of a hill a little bit and you let off the gas and then you turn around. My mother was driving, and she was greenhorn as greenhorn could get. She didn't know how to drive it. She was scared to go up this hill. My dad was wanting her to go up. Anyways, I was behind her, so I was like holding her, and she decided to do a 3-point turn to turn around. She went up the hill, and for some reason she gassed, she let push the gas in, and when she pushed the gas in, the four wheeler went up the side of the hill, and then it flipped straight back. So I fell off and I landed on my back on the ground. My mother, she fell off and she kind of rolled to the side. And that it was a Foreman, I think 350, I can't remember, big four wheeler, that's all I remember. It came down, and the handlebar actually came down and snapped my right femur in half. Snapped it into kind of like an X shape there, and missed my main artery by 3 millimeters. Went, you know, we found this out after I went to the doctor, and then I ended up having to stay in a body cast from my chest all the way down to my toes, and my legs were in a V shape like this for the whole time because they needed to keep my leg in traction or whatever it was. So that was my first like traumatic thing. You know, I remember being in the hospital. That was kind of like my earliest memories, being in the hospital and stuff like that. And then, you know, later in life, my parents ended up getting divorced. That was terrible. You know, I was hid in an attic. I was 8. Yeah.
Man.
7, 8 years old. Yeah, 8. Yeah. 8 is when they finalized it. But you know, from 7 to 8 years old, my parents, they went through a horrible divorce because both sides of my family were basically fighting over me and my sister. They wanted me to go to my mom's side, they wanted me to go to my dad's side. And there was a lot of crazy stuff that happened with that, but it was that was a point where I had to grow up quick. And the biggest memory I had from that, or the kind of traumatic thing with that, was I'll never forget going in the courtroom, and the judge, you know, at this time, I was sitting there and I was looking up at the judge, and I was holding my sister's hand. And this is like when they're finalizing everything or whatnot. And I remember looking at the judge. He had asked me a question. He said, "Hey, you're old enough to decide." And I'm like sitting here thinking to myself, like, I'm only 8 years old. Like, what am I deciding?
Old. That's wild.
Old. And I remember standing there in front of the judge, and he said, "You're old enough to understand, or you're old enough to make a decision." And he said, "Who you want to stay with?" And I remember, like, I was in a panic, and I was like looking at my sister, and I was looking at him, I was looking at my sister, and I kept kind of like looking around the room, and I was just kind of like couldn't figure it out. And he's like, "Who do you want to stay with?" He got stern with me, and it kind of intimidated me. And I remember just rushing, and I was like, my dad, and I just threw it out there. And then he threw his gavel down, and he said, "Mr. Fouch, you have full custody of your children." That was it. Oh. Yeah, I know it's crazy to believe, but I mean, before my parents got divorced, I mean, my dad's side of the family, they hid me in an attic. My mother had come over to like get custody of me, but they were trying to keep her away because they thought she was going to run off with us. And they hid me and my sister in an attic. And I remember looking through a window. There's a little small little like the looks like a stop sign kind of little window. I remember looking through there, just screaming bloody murder at my mom, like help me, please. Like, I see you there. And they kept us in the attic until she left, and just all kinds of stuff. I remember my house just dissolving at that point. And then fast
horror film.
Dude, I want to write a book one day. I mean, some of these stories I tell y'all tonight, man, you either believe it or you don't. I'll tell you, I got scars to prove it. I got eyewitness testimonies. Like, life has not been easy for me, but I know I'm getting to your answer, Fred. I'm sorry. I'm a long storyteller, for a short answer.
Maybe.
Fast forward, you know, I'm in my dad's custody. We're living in Kentucky. This would probably be the most traumatic thing, that happened that really caused a big spiral in my life. That this is really kind of like the tip of the iceberg that kind of led me to the downfall, like me going into a valley. My dad had purchased some little 50 cc, I forget what they were, real small tiny yellow Suzuki four-wheelers, and we had been riding them for, you know, a while. I forget how long we had them, but one day, my cousins, they lived right up the road. Me and my cousins, we were riding my four-wheeler and my sister's four-wheeler. We had matching four-wheelers, and my cousins, they didn't take care of anything. They broke everything they touched. And so anyways, we're pushing my sister's four-wheeler back, and I'm riding my four-wheeler back, and my dad's in the driveway. And my dad, he sees that the four-wheeler's messed up, and my dad loses it. He tells my cousin's name's Roger. He tells him, he says, you know, go the fuck home, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm fucking whatever. So I get mad at my dad and I'm pissed off. And I just tell him, fuck you, dad, you know, whatever. And I'm scurrying away on my four wheeler. And just kind of pay
time.
Nine.
Okay. Keep going.
So 9 year old on a four wheeler. Yeah. So, anyways, just kind of give you an idea of like how this all played out. I lived right beside of a two lane highway. And on the other side of the road was a field that we used to ride in. And then on the other side was where all of our houses and stuff were. So I got mad at my dad. I told him, you know, fuck you, dad, whatever. And I crossed the road and I went into the field, and my cousin, he's walking on the house side of the road. So he's walking down the white line going on that side. And I'm sitting here, I'm going down the field on this side, and I'm talking to him, my cousin, and I'm like, hey, let's go to your house, you know, let's go to your house and hang out, whatever. So as we're walking, there's this cut that we had cut the fence. It was like one of those, it was like those big wooden poles with, it looks like cattle fence kind of in a way. So we had cut a section out so we could cross over and go up the holler. So that's where my cousin lived. He lived up the holler, and we have crossed that road 1,000 times, like millions of times if you really want to get technical with it. But anyways, so I pull up to that, and I'm sitting there, and the last thing I remember is I pull up to that spot right about to cut over the road, and I'm talking to my cousin. He's to my right. To my left, there's a bunch of, like, we call it horse weed. It looks like, I call it hillbilly bamboo, but all this stuff grows like 12, 14 feet tall real quick. So anyways, it was all grown up real thick over here to the left. And there's the road comes from an uphill to a downhill right where I was at. And it kind of curves. So you can't really see the traffic. You got to like look, and you got to like look through the thicket and listen and all that stuff. So I'm sitting there, and I've let a couple cars pass, you know, and I'm still talking to my cousin. And then we see his dad go up the holler. I'm like, hey, your dad's home, let's just go. And so the last thing I remember is I pull out and everything went black. The rest of the story, this is told by my dad, what he had witnessed. So I had pulled out, and as soon as I pulled out, I got hit by a dually pickup truck. Basically, it was a Ford dually pickup truck, a red Ford dually pickup truck going 55 miles an hour. He was supposed to be going 35, but he was going 55. So I had pulled out right in front of him. He had directly T-boned me. I was wearing no protective gear, nothing to protect my skin. I had no helmet, no nothing. So he hit me head on. As soon as he hit me, I started to go underneath of the truck with the four-wheeler and everything. The four-wheeler was twisting, I was twisting with it. I had road rash on my face. It ate a piece of my shoulder off, ate my arm up pretty good, and my knuckles. You can probably see the shiner, the scars there. But anyways, I'm getting twisted and dragged underneath of this truck, and the guy who hit me, he told his side of the story. He said that he had thought he had hit a small deer or a small dog, so he kept going. Unfortunately, though, when he hit me, he had hit his brakes because that sudden, oh crap, I just hit something. When I w went under his truck, I had actually severed his brake line on the right side. So his truck, when he hit the brakes, it pulled left. And when it pulled left, he hit my cousin head on. And my cousin got
Shit.
hit head on. My cousin got hit head on. He's just walking. Head on, he flips 100 feet in the air and he lands on his head and he lays in just a pool of blood. And then eventually the truck pulled back over into the lane he was in. And my dad had witnessed all of this. Like, my dad watched every piece of it happen.
It's like a final destination.
Dude, I'm telling you, like, it's wild. So anyways, my dad, he had witnessed all of this and his adrenaline kicked in. He just took off. He started running. And he ran, and it took him several minutes to get me out from under the truck because I was twisted in with the four-wheeler. I was mangled all to pieces. It ended up giving me severe road rash. I had gravel in my arm, like all kinds of stuff. And it ended up breaking all of my ribs on my left side. My head, this side of my head, my left side of my head got hit. I've got a nice, I don't know if you can see it on the camera, but I've got a nice little dent in my head right here from hitting the ground. And it broke my left leg in four places, broke my tibia, my fibia, and my femur all in four places. And then, so once he ripped me out from underneath of there, he had me like on his shoulder and he was carrying me over to my cousin. And mind you, I'm unconscious. I don't know. I have no recollection of any of this. It just went black as soon as I pulled out. He had attempted to get my cousin. He was going to put us in a car and take us to the hospital. But by that time, a crowd had already formed and several people were around him. They're like, don't touch him. He's dead. He's dead. He ended up actually surviving. So I'm sorry. He survived. He actually, I think he got the worst of it. His tibia and fibia, basically the lower portion of his leg, there was a good 4 to 6 inches of the middle portion of his leg completely gone, to include the bone and muscle. His leg was only hanging out on by a tether of skin. He had to have several reconstructive surgeries, muscles taken out of his back. That's part of his testimony, but it's crazy. So my dad ended up throwing me in a car. Some girl had just graduated high school, and then he said drive, and the hospital was 2 miles down the road. So he drove me down there, and they immediately flew me out, and I had a nice. They had to put pins in my leg, but they were removable. They took them out afterwards. I ended up getting four pins in my femur to connect the two broken places, and then I had the halo rig. It's like a metal ring looking thing. You've probably seen it, like people had it on their arms and stuff. I had that on my lower leg and I had to wear that
Bad
thing for a
movies, but
while.
yeah.
But yeah, that was the sorry. That was kind of the, like I said before, that was the tip. That was the tip of the iceberg that kind of led to this whole I was nine. Yeah. So 9 years old, I get into a my near fatal ATV accident, nearly killed me and my cousin or whatever. The doctors thought it would be a great idea at this point, me being 9 years old, to prescribe me liquid Lortab for my pain. And for anybody who's not familiar with what Lortab is, Lortab's an opiate.
Hit Kentucky right there. Like you said before, there's a couple things you can do, and one of them is be a drug addict, but please continue.
You're right on the money, man. Like, right where I grew up, it was the opioid epidemic. That's where the epicenter of it started. I think they did a study on it, several years ago, but they found out there was 1 million pills, opiate pills, to every one person in that region. 1 million pills they were prescribing per one person. You tell me, man, I could go down a rabbit hole in that one, but anyways.
Let's talk about Narcans. No, I'm just kidding.
But they ended up prescribing me liquid Lortab at the time, at 9 years old. Yeah, I ended up taking that for, you know, I don't know how long I took it for. So that was my, yeah, I was 9 years old. So that was, I want to say my fourth grade year. Yeah, so fifth grade. Yeah, that's when I wanted, yeah, so fifth grade, all that surpassed. And then, actually, no, it was my fifth grade year. Oh, and mind you, that happened on Father's Day, too, of 2000 and, no, it was year 2000 when it happened. Yeah. So that was on Father's Day, year 2000. And then, so that was fourth grade, and then fifth grade is when I wanted to join the military. But anyways, yeah. So, you know, they prescribed me that. I didn't think I had an addiction at that point. It wasn't until my sixth grade year. And this is where the kind of the buddy aspect of my father comes into play. And this is where, you know, stop me if you have any questions. But this is kind of where this is the darkest point really begins. Like that was the nuclear bomb that kind of like set it off. And then the fallout is what occurs next. But and you know, do I blame myself for what happened after the fact? Yeah, I do. I don't care how young I was. I knew it wasn't right. I'm not going to be one to sit here and say, oh, you know, woe is me, play the victim. You know, I don't do that. Do I feel sorry for myself sometimes? Hell yeah, I do, man. Like, I don't think it's wrong to feel sorry for yourself, but, you know, do that for 10 minutes and then move on. You know, you got to push yourself through. You can't sit here and play this. You can't wallow in your feelings. You know, I think that's really what gets us into predicaments is we sit here and wallow and we put ourselves in this victim mentality and we needlessly suffer for letting our mind spiral. Right, yeah. So sixth grade year that started, which I started to develop a lot of pain, like chronic pain at like 10 years old, 11 years old, whatever. So chronic pain was a new experience in my life, and I'll never forget it. Now, kind of give you a little backstory on my dad. I'm not going to go too much in depth with him. You know, he had suffered with addiction from the 70s, and mind you, my dad, you know, he had been through two marriages. The second marriage he had was when he married my mom. But he had been through two marriages. He grew up as a, you know, grew up in Eastern Kentucky, worked as a coal miner, a car mechanic. He had back problems. He had to have back surgery, all this crazy stuff. So opioids were a big part of his life, unfortunately, just because of the pain that he experienced. So sixth grade year, I'm in school, and I remember I'm walking to class, and I remember my legs. Now, I don't know for sure if like I was going through growing pains in combination with like the pains I was feeling from having broken legs in the past. I'm sure that accounted to it, but, or attributed to it. But, I remember I went to the office and I called my dad and I said, Dad, can you please pick me up? I'm in a lot of pain. Like my legs are hurting really bad. And mind you, I'm not taking anything, none of that stuff.
Been at this point since you came off the painkillers.
So they only had me on the painkillers, you know, I'm really just guessing on this, but they only really had me on the painkillers while I was, you know, I had the pins and stuff in my legs and probably a couple months afterwards. So gotcha. I'd probably been off the painkillers for maybe 2 years, 3 years at max, if that, I think 2 years. So my dad, he tells me on the phone, he was working, so he couldn't, you know, come and pick me up because he worked at home, but he had a body shop. He would work on vehicles that and everything. So he said, hey, look, I'm going to send, I don't remember what this guy's name was, but he had the nickname of Stinky. He was this big old jolly green giant white dude, and he stunk terrible. So that's where he got his name, Stinky. But anyway,
Fred, but yeah, please continue.
So, I was in the hallway and they called me to the office, and Stinky had walked up to me in the hallway. And he handed me something. And he's like, hey, your dad said, here, take this, and you'll be all right till you get home. I was like, okay. And I had no idea what it was. He had given me like this white pill, and it was a opioid. I think it was a Lortab. I don't know. Whatever it was pretty strong. So I took it. He handed me a soda or something, and I took it right there in the hallway. And I didn't think anything of it. Next thing I know, probably 15, 20 minutes later, I'm asking to go to the bathroom, and I'm in the bathroom, and my gut, it feels like there is a small rodent in my gut, like ripping my insides apart. That's how painful it was, because I had taken it on an empty stomach and all this. So I went through that pain for probably a good 20, 30 minutes in the bathroom. Surprised nobody came to check in on me, but you know, whatever. And then I remember after I got through the pain, I was like, I remember getting up and I'm like, God, I feel really good right now. Like the pain is gone. Like I haven't felt this good in a while. Like this is pretty nice. So right there, that was the moment. That was the spark that led to the fire of a 7-year long addiction. So mind you, sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade. I pretty much was, I went through a lot of stuff during that time. The biggest thing was middle school. I got bullied a tremendous amount. I got choked in the wall, up against the wall. I got punched. I got in needless fights. I wouldn't fight back because I was terrified, because I was afraid I was going to break something, because my parents always told me I couldn't play football or baseball or anything like that, because I had already broke my legs twice and they didn't want me to break anything else. And I've nearly died twice at this point. So anyways, I was getting bullied. It was pretty bad. I think it was my seventh grade, spring break. I had went, to go to on a trip to Myrtle Beach. If you don't believe these stories, like you can tap out right now. Like it's about to get crazy. But it is true. It happened. I don't know. Believe it or not. I don't know. I feel like I'm Ripley's Believe It or Not sometimes, but, anyways, and you know, I can go into detail on what happened here, but basically we went on a trip to Myrtle Beach. So my cousin, Michael, this is a different cousin, could go and see his mother, who he hadn't seen in a couple years. So it was me and my mother, my cousin and my sister. So all four of us, we went on a trip to Myrtle Beach. We left late in the evening. We started to complain that we were hungry, and mind you, it's like 12:30 at night and we haven't even gotten there yet. I think we were in North Carolina at this point. And my mom had missed several exits to go to, you know, McDonald's and all this stuff. So eventually you see an exit to a Waffle House. So we go to the Waffle House and we're going in there, and we go in there, we sit down, and if you've ever been in a Waffle House, you kind of know the general layout of a waffle. Yeah,
Fred. Right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 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 So there's two guys working there, and you know, I'm not being racist when I say this, but there was a black guy that was a cook and a white guy that was a cashier. It's the only way I can really remember what played out here. But we sat down. So you know how in Waffle House you got the bar where you can sit, and then at the end they had the cash register. So at the end where the cash register was, we were on the booth, or we were sitting in the booth where the cash register was. And I was sitting on the far side. So if I stood up, I would literally, like, I'd turn left and the cash register would be right there. So we're sitting there, we're eating, and I had just complained to the cook. I was like, hey man, these eggs, bro, they like paper on the bottom. And I told him, I was like, hey, can you recook my eggs? And
man, you're at a Waffle House.
Yeah.
So anyways, he turned around and he looked nervous, and I'm like, why is he so nervous? But anyways, I didn't think anything of it at the time. I remember looking out the doors. You know how they got the little zigzag you got to walk through to come in? I remember looking out the doors, there was a dude that came in, small dude. And I got to put my hood on to show you what I'm talking about. So this dude came in, he had a hood on, and he looked like this. Just like that. Coming into the Waffle House. All right.
Right.
I thought it was cold, and I'm like, wait a second, it's like the middle of spring break, it's like warm, everybody's going to the beaches. So my intuition started to kick in, and I'm like, that's a little weird. The next thing I know, I look over, and my eggs are over here burning. The dude, the black dude that was a cook, he had actually took off. He took off as soon as that guy came through the door. So I'm like, what in the world? So I look back over at the door, and there was this guy came in, and it was another black dude, but like I said, I don't know these guys' names, but this guy came in and he had his meanest look on his face, what like you can imagine. And
up his eggs as well.
Dude, they were pissed. They came in with some hell and discontent following right behind them. But anyways, they came in. The little dude, little Mexican dude, I guess is what they told us. But mind you, I'm only in middle school, so I don't know much of anything. So he runs around the counter and he's like trying to break in the safe. And this dude that came in behind him, and I'll never forget it. He was like an average build black dude. He looked pretty good. You know, he was pretty thick, but, I'll never forget it. He walked in and in his hood he had on, he pulled out this like 6-shot revolver, and the cashier, the white dude, he's standing behind the register. And he points that pistol at him and he said, this is a stick up. Give me all the money. And I'm like, I'm sitting there and I'm looking over my right shoulder at this dude. And I'm like, are you serious right now? I'm not kidding. I looked right at this dude and I said, are you serious right now? And he looked at me. He took all of his attention off of that cashier. He pointed that damn gun and he put it right here on the front on my forehead, and I can remember this. I could feel the cold steel on my forehead, and I remember seeing the hollow point bullets he had in the revolver. I could see them through the cylinder, and at that point I just shut up, and I kind of like was like, all right. So anyways, this guy ends up robbing the Waffle House. The cook, the black dude that was there, whatever, he was actually in on it. He had convinced his buddies, hey, you know, I know you're coming, so just, you know, open the door real loud and I'll run out, kind of thing. The white dude that was there had no idea what was going on. He held the gun to my head and then he made us all stand up. And at the time we didn't really have cell phones and all that stuff, but he took us to the back of the restaurant where the restrooms were, and he made us line up against the wall and he made us lift up our shirts to make sure we didn't have any pagers or any of that stuff on us. And the whole time he's doing this, he's got the gun on my head because I'm a threat to him at this point. I was just as tall as he was. Like, I think back on it, like I could have totally took this dude, but that would have been dumb. Anyways, I was young and dumb at that point. But he pushed us into the bathroom and closed the door behind us, and then that's when everybody started to panic. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, how can I prevent him from coming in here and shooting us? So my mom's in a panic, and she's taking her rings off and stuff like that, and she eventually shoves them up underneath of the sink, and shoves them under the sink, and then she starts losing it. My sister and my cousin, they're losing it. They're hysterical. They're 3 years younger than me, by the way. And then eventually I said, you know what? I know this dude's going to come back. Like, he's going to make sure there's no witnesses, kind of thing. So I remember like bear hugging my family, and I just lost it at that point. And I'll never forget I hear the door creak open, and that was the, like, we were praying and everything. Like, that was the only thing we could do, was just pray. And I remember the door creaking open, and I heard a voice. But during that whole time, like up until that point, I had like, and if you don't believe in flashbacks, like your whole life flashing back before your eyes kind of thing, it happens. I had that happen, and then I heard a voice, and I thought I was dead. I thought he had come back in and started shooting into us, kind of thing. And come to find out, it was the dude, it was the cashier, the white dude that was the behind the register. So when he took us to the back to put us in the bathroom, the cashier, he had basically ran off to the hotel next door because they had cut the phone lines, so we couldn't call. You know, for people who don't know what phone lines are, it's, you know, it's an antique kind of phone, like you had to plug into a wall kind of thing. But they had cut the phone lines and he ran over and he called 911. So by the time he came back, both those dudes were gone. And then he came in, I heard his voice. He said, Hey, they're gone. And then I lost it. I was like fetal position, hiding underneath the table. Like, never forget that. But that was middle school, spring break. And then,
so at this age, what would you say? We're probably like 40% through your life and we've filled a book already. Like, this is,
that's a lot.
I'm telling you, man, I could write like a whole series of like, not even 40%. Like, we're a third of the way through my life at that point, up to this point. Like, I'm 12, 14 years old, whatever age I was. But one that they had robbed us at, I think it was in Florence, North Carolina. I'm going off of memory, but they ended
Florence
up
in South
Carolina. Okay, Florence, South Carolina. We've been to it. It had a hotel next
to
it.
I was in the town of Florence, and we had.
You probably went to the Waffle House I got robbed at. I'm not kidding you. I could pull it up on a map, but anyways, these guys, they ended up getting caught at the Waffle House that they had robbed us at initially. So we were their first victims, and they ended up getting caught at the same place after they had went on a year and a half, 2 year spree of robbing Waffle Houses. They called them the Waffle House Bandits. And I have looked all over the internet trying to find articles about these dudes, but I just can't find it. Anyways, yeah, Bandits, they
from Home Alone.
So they knew the layout of Waffle Houses. They knew where the phone lines were. They knew where the safes were. They knew the routine. Like, they had it master planned out, man. These guys were smart. But it was in Florence, South Carolina. I said it was North Carolina, but yeah, Florence, South Carolina is where it happened. But and then we ended up. Go ahead.
No.
Okay. Yeah. So this is where the trauma really sets in, because not only did I just get robbed at Waffle House by gunpoint, and you know the dude held the gun on my forehead. But we end up going to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and we go to where my aunt was staying, and we go into this weird ass house, and I'm like, what in the world? Like, I just remember there's a bunch of people there, And it wasn't until later in life, I really, like, going through therapy and stuff, figured out what was going on. My aunt was a full-blown meth addict, and she was in a crack house, basically. So my mom thought it would be a good idea. And I love my mom to death. There are some things that, you know, I wish she wouldn't have done, but you know, she's still living. So if you're watching this, mom, I love you, but I know you had a messed up past too. And we all make mistakes, but I refuse to make those same mistakes with my children. But anyways, not to call you out or anything, but I know life's tough, but whatever. I told you I'm a straight shooter. Like,
I like it.
But, we went into this house and there was all these people like laying on the couch, laying on the floor and all this stuff. And I remember they sat me and my sister down on a couch and these fucking weird people came up to us and they're like, oh, poor baby, what happened? And I just remember these people, like, I could count how many teeth four people had in one hand. Like, it was, oh, dude, it was weird. It was like sitting around a bunch of zombies. And my mom was amiss. Like, she was just gone. Like, we had nobody we knew, and I just remember cuddled up to my sister and my cousin, like, scared to death. I didn't sleep for 3 days straight after that. Like, I went 3 straight days not being able to sleep until finally my body was like, nope, and then I just shut down and I slept for, like, two. But, you know, come back from spring break, you know, I was supposed to be having fun, and I go back to middle school, but I know you had some questions, Cam.
Yeah, so... like we said before, you know, 40% of your life or whatever, but I wanted to go back with, you said you struggled with the 7 years of addiction and you touched on how that started. Did your dad know about like how you were using the same stuff, or how did that work? What was that dynamic like?
Glad you asked that, because my dad was an addict and he had a prescription. And if you don't have to go find a drug dealer, your dad's the best version of a drug dealer that you can find, and hey, guess what, you don't have to pay for anything. So that's how I got my stuff. My dad, he would willingly give it to me when his script was full, and then I remember he would hide it once the script started getting low. And, you know, like I said, I love my dad to death. He was a drug addict. He was also a drug dealer. And, you know, he never did anything. I mean, minus the drug dealing part, like he never dealt anything like wild. He wasn't like cocaine, meth, none of that stuff. But it's mainly the pain pills
because he would kid.
All right. So he would go on trips to Florida. He would fly to Florida randomly and go get, you know, 5 to 1,000 Oxycontin and come back with them and sell them for, you know, $10-$20 per milligram, whatever it was. I don't remember. But yeah, my dad was the main supplier. He would hand them to me. Basically, I would just go down and say, "Hey, Dad, my legs hurt. You know, hey, my back hurts, whatever." And he would, "Here you go." He'd just hand it to me, and then,
And you said, you had said before that, you know, don't place blame on anybody. You know, however you did it with yourself, and you knew what you were doing. But was there any point then, or even after that, where you blamed him for like enabling that?
That's where coming into this, like I started out with, like, I wish my dad was more of a father, not a buddy, not like a friend kind of thing. Cause friends will tell you, hey, you probably shouldn't do that, but they won't, like, you know, this is subjective. So this is general. Don't take this to heart, but you know, friends will sit here and tell you, hey, you probably shouldn't do that or whatever, but they're not going to push you in most cases. Like if you don't have that, like if you're not like best buds or they know every detail of your life, they're not going to make you change your ways. But that was kind of the issue with my dad, was like, he never sat down and said, hey, like you shouldn't do this anymore. And to answer your question, I do blame my father, because at that time I was young. I was immature. Like I know it was wrong. Of course I did. I grew up with the whole dog thing. Like, don't do drugs, kids. You know, that freaking drug dog or whatever it was they'd bring to the school, and you're like, good God, this is awkward, you know, that thing. So I knew it was wrong, but at the same time, that was my coping mechanism. That was what I was using to get through the bullying. That was what I was using to get through the pain. That was what I was using to get through the fear. I had a legitimate fear of going to school. Like I would fake being sick. Intentionally, I would take a hot rag and put it on my forehead, and then as soon as I take the rag off, I'd wipe it clean real quick, and I'd run to my dad and be like, Dad, I got a fever, you know. I would go that far with it, not to go to school, because I was afraid of the two guys that were bullying me were going to bully me or going to harm me or do something. And then I figured out that, oh wait, not only do these pills help my, you know, pain, but they also help me with, you know, I'm more talkative. Yeah. I can function with my anxiety, you know, all of this. And at the time I didn't really know what all that was. Like they told me I was depressed and all this stuff. I was like, what the hell is that? You know, are you pushing on me? Like, what does that mean? You know, but yeah, you know, I do blame my father. I wish he would have stepped in and been a father more than a buddy. And you know, he was the precursor that started my addiction that, you know, I still, you know, when I say this, I don't want anybody to feel discouraged. I want to say it so people understand it better. Do I think addiction is a personal choice? No, I don't think addiction is a personal choice. And, you know, this is up to interpretation, but I think there are some people that are led into addiction either by a family member, a friend, a peer, or even a doctor. That have pushed them into that. And do I blame the person that's an addict? Yeah, 50-50. You know, it's, you know, is it a choice to some degree? Yes. But, you know, sometimes it is pushed onto people, and, you know, it's one of those ruts that you get in, and I'll be damned if it's one of the hardest ruts I've ever tried to dig myself out of. But.
Cause like for me,
yeah.
Talk about your dad being a friend. A friend to me, and I think as time goes on, I start to understand guys, my friends, right? The brothers that I would ride and die with, the guys that I trust with my kid. If I was, they would never offer me like an opioid, if you will, like to calm me down. If I was ever over abusing anything, Fred would never say like, hey man, take this thing, or he would come back and continue pushing it, if you will. To me, it's a drug dealer. And I mean, it's, I don't know your dad. This is the first time I ever met you, Preston, but
yeah, yeah.
Like somebody, pushing that on you, you know, it's going to be bad. And this is the, we do the best we can with what we know and what we're willing to learn. But if somebody's pushing that on you, and I mean, I'm not talking to you like you're a child, but it's,
no.
To me, it's like that standard. I've had guys where I was in the thick of things and, you know, Fred would kick the bottle out of my hand. Cobra, that we talk about, you know, a lot on the podcast. He would show up to the house and be like, you're not drinking this anymore. You have to go do this thing. So it's these guys pushing you. Essentially, they're investing into your future by like kicking these things out of your hands, if you will.
No, I agree.
So it's like a friend, dad. So we have labels in society like dad, you shouldn't do this thing, or friends. Like what are, I mean, we could tear this down, and this is something that I want to continue with you guys, because obviously, I mean, you've got a lot to unpack here, and it's beautiful. It really is. We could tear this down in like two or three episodes right now, and your transparency, which is beautiful. I mean, you're painting a whole picture here, and the thing that a lot of people out there in the world is like hearing from your stories, you know, this is real life. This is what happened. You're not candy coating anything. You're not. This is just straight up what happened, and I think this is what the world has to hear. And then we can start to tear down, you know, the difference between dad, the difference between parent, friends, you know what I mean?
So part of the reason with the question I asked was, this, as much as this is about you, it's about who can relate to you, who can latch onto your story and learn from your lessons, or at least know that they're not the only ones going through it, right? So it sounds like everything prior to you becoming a man, we really can't put it on you. We can't blame you for it. Even if you know right from wrong, there's just a level of responsibility that you'll never have as a kid, you know? And as a man, you can take hyper responsibility and accountability for things you've done when you knew they were wrong either way, like stealing your first candy bar or something, you know? You knew it was wrong, but you did it. And so the difference is now when we look at the people that are going to hear your story, I would say, honestly, that whole first section was all, you know, pretty bleak, right? I mean, there were some sure bright spots in your childhood, but to date, I don't know anybody who's had a more turmoil-filled childhood as you. So congratulations. You made it.
Appreciate it.
You're here to talk about it.
Always strive to be on top. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the battlefield battle, right? You know what I mean? But now, as you assimilate that to after you became a man, after you became responsible for children, after you became responsible for a woman, like it's not like dating as a teenager.
Oh, yeah.
Like dating as a man. And now when you go do something stupid and you break somebody's heart, you can kind of see the ripple effect of what it becomes. You know what I mean? And so whatever the greatest dark spot of your childhood compared to the next podcast or the second half of this story, if you will, when you were a man, I want to see how it's different, right? There's a different way. Like the greatest thing that ever happened to you when you were 7 years old was the greatest thing that ever happened to you in your life. Now, if that same thing happened again when you were 15, you've already been through it. You've almost died twice. You know what I mean? Like, so, or more, you know? And so it's like the first time you strike this, it's the biggest thing that ever happened. The second time you strike it, you kind of know how to manage it, you know? And that's how life goes. So it's got to be something bigger. And you successfully made it bigger and bigger. You know what I mean? But now that you're on this side of childhood, now you're responsible for things, the biggest thing that can happen to you may not have happened yet, but to date, you know, it could far outweigh, you know.
Trauma, yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
Right now, a lot of this that you've unpacked, to me, it's like if you were to walk into a therapist's office, and this is where I'm going to really like, this is where Jay, the wife, has been pushing me. Like, you guys, what you guys have is like this community, and we talk to therapists, right? So it's like, there's something wrong with me. And you raise the hand and like, there's something wrong with me. And you go and you talk to these therapists, and therapists will say, all right, let's talk about the inner child. Let's go back to your childhood, because that's where a lot of the foundation is, right? And you unpack that childhood. And it's like, okay, now what's after that? And it's like, well, the therapist, I mean, do you have the coding? Do you have the understanding to what I went through afterwards? Do you have the understanding of like when I went through the military and then the traumas afterwards? Like, as a therapist, you know, you could be a 25-year-old therapist fresh out of college, and it's like, have you experienced life the way that I have? 5 kids. You know, and unpacking these other things. And what I would like to do is, we went through Preston's, like, the childhood. So it's like, this is the stuff that you unpacked with your therapist, right? You'll talk openly with us, probably with anybody in the world. You're willing to be raw with it, you know? I don't give a shit. I'll talk about it. Mom, I'm sorry, but this, I just have to call it for what it is. Dad, it is what it is. So as, what I want to do is, if it's cool with you guys, and especially you, Preston, let's unpack, let's do podcast part two. I want to unpack, like, all right, so I did join the military based on whatever principles. And that's something that we can start to tear down. And then after the military, I went through these things, and this is how it's different. This is what I've learned.
So then should we wrap this up with some takeaway points, some ideas that, because I think people still struggle with owning things they had no right to own.
I agree with you. Yep.
Childhood traumas that they own that they were never responsible for, and they carry these weights, and you could speak to that. You know, how did you process out of that? How did you figure out, how long did it take to figure out that I was a kid, you know? Yeah. you the parent, you know what I mean? Like, how did you come to that, you know, that understanding? How would you help somebody else to make that leap between taking, yeah.
So for me, like, if I was to talk to someone who's gone through that and is carrying the baggage of their past, I'll be straightforward. I'm a faith-based person. You know, I believe in Jesus, all that, and I'm not pushing religion on anybody or whatnot, but
preach it.
That's what's got me through a lot of my baggage. And what I mean by that is, I'm a firm believer of like generational curses. And for the addiction aspect, you know, just kind of what I'm talking about here, and to answer your question about, like, you know, holding on to things that you weren't responsible for. You know, my grandfather was an addict. Both sides of my family, my mom and dad's sides, they had addicts on both sides. Like, I'm coming from a very great lineage here. So I'm destined for failure, like, from the get go. And, I think the biggest thing that I learned that I would tell somebody that is holding on to past things is something that I learned later in life when I went to, look, if you're an alcoholic, if you're a drug addict like I was, like taking opioids, or if you're doing the big wig stuff, I never tapped into that stuff. I was too afraid to die, and I didn't trust anybody. I was a little paranoid. But if I were to give any advice to anybody like listening to this, just up until what we've talked about here, you know, I went to an AA meeting and I wasn't an alcoholic. My therapist had said, you're going to an AA meeting. I'm like, I ain't going to an AA meeting. I don't drink. You know, this is later in life, you know, this is after the Marine Corps, and that's a whole nother story, but I'll never forget going to the AA meeting, and people were talking about, you know, they're talking about generational curses and, you know, holding on to things and, just being able to let go. But going to those meetings, like, I understood that being able to tell your story to someone you trust that's willing to help you, so having someone that holds you accountable, so having an accountability person really helps. But as far as holding on to things that you had no like responsibility holding on to, your past is your past. And this is the main thing that I learned in going to AA. you know, they would hand out these little coins, and you know, you get your first 24-hour coin, and then you get your, I think you get like a week coin or something, I forget. But I'll never forget the guy that was up there leading it, and he would be up there passing out the coins to people, and he would always stop and say, look, this 24-hour coin is the most important coin out of any of these others. I don't care if you're sober 20 years. I don't care if you're sober 30 years. I don't care if you've been sober for 20, you know, 20 days. He said, this 24-hour one is the most important. Yep. Yeah, one day. And I was sitting there. I was like, well, what does this guy mean? Like, I get that. But, dude, this guy next to me just celebrated 4 years. Like, that's incredible. 4 years not picking up the bottle kind of thing. And for anybody who's holding on to something that is in the past, you have three realities that you have the ability to live in. You have the past, you have the present, and then you have the future. And you get to choose which of those realities you live in. And what I mean by that is, if you're someone who is carrying things that you don't need to carry that happened in your past that you had no responsibility for, you're living in the past. You have this whole mindset, and it, you know, it talks about it in the Bible, is renewing your mind, renew your mind, renew your mind, and you know, do not be afraid. Those are do not be afraid is reiterated, but throughout the Bible. But the changing of their mind, I forget the Bible verse, I can't really think of it this moment, but it's the changing of your mind. So when he was up there talking about that 24-hour coin, it made so much sense to me. Like, I've had people tell me this a million times before. Well, you only get the day, you know, live the day, and all this hippity dippity bullshit, I call it. You only get today, you know, don't worry about your past, man, and don't worry about the future. But it made sense. It made sense to me in that moment because the guy was being very serious about it, and he
just
basically
being present. Yeah.
Present.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was the biggest thing with a lot of the therapies and stuff I went through too. Yes, I had a lot of baggage from my past. Good God, I had a freaking 747 load of baggage that I was carrying with me, and by the time I was 18 years old, like, you know, we only got to middle school on this part here, but it was the 24 hours. Like, I have a day. Like, when I wake up in the morning, what choice I make first thing in the morning is what's going to determine the rest of my day. And I don't care if you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I don't care if you wake up at, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning or whatever. Even if you wake up in the afternoon, I've been through depression. I know how it goes. I'll sleep all day if I'm in a terrible mood. But, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you gotta give yourself the grace to understand that, hey, look, you went through this, but you made it. You may have had this happen to you, but you made it. You're here now.
Absolutely.
I always tell my children this, and this is a huge thing I've learned as like just being a parent. You know, no one ever sat down with me when I was afraid as a kid and terrified and going through anxiety and all that. Every time my kids get afraid, like of anything, or if they're crying, or if they just got hurt or something like that, and I know it's not like life threatening, I look them in the eyes and I say, hey, bud, it's okay. You're safe. You are safe. And I keep reiterating to them, you're safe. You are loved and you are safe. I know you just got hurt. I know you're afraid of the monster under your bed, but look at me. You're safe. This is a safe place for you to be. And I'm not going into this whole hippity dippity safe space crap. I'm saying you got to look at the present moment of being, hey, look, I'm in a safe space. I'm in my bed. I just woke up. I am not in the middle of combat. I am not in the middle of, you know, my father abusing me. I'm not in the middle of, you know, my addiction eating into my soul. I have just woken up. I am fresh. Like, this is my day. For the next however many hours I'm up is going to be determined by what I do in the present moment. And if that's too much for you to handle, I get it. There's been days where, I mean, going through boot camp, I was living chow to chow. It was terrible. I hated boot camp. You know, everybody's like, oh, you big wimp, boot camp wasn't nothing. Yeah, well, if you're 125 pounds soaking wet and you never worked out a day in your life and you go to boot camp, hell yeah, it's tough. So, you know, that's if if someone's got baggage that they're holding on to that they had no responsibility for, look at it from this lens of perspective. Life is about a lot of perspective. I've come to learn that too. That baggage was not yours to carry. You were just a member, or you were just a character in that moment. And if something happened to you, I'm not downplaying what happened to you. I'm sorry you went through that. But when that happened is when that happened, and that was in the past. And you've got to focus on the 24 hours that you were given. I mean,
that's doing the work to maneuver through, you know, and that's where the work starts. And that's something that we're going to unpack that. Cause like you're starting to, which is awesome. And I love it. You're starting to get into like the post-military side or during the military, I think.
Yeah.
It's like, you're starting to understand I am in this thing and I have to maneuver through it, because a lot of the world today, they sit in it. And they reflect on the past, and it's like, no. And that's the beautiful thing about the military, something that is, I think, taught all of us is, no, you have this thing in front of you, you got a problem, so what's the solution? Find the solution.
Absolutely. I agree.
I'm a huge man of faith myself. I'm a Christian. I do believe that faith as a term doesn't have to necessarily lie with Christianity. Faith is a belief of something bigger than you, something that the universe, if you will, something that moves and controls things a little bit more than you can, so that you're just not like fully out here on your own, like an atheist, if you will, you know? And then as a Christian, I've heard a lot of cliches, you know, you hear them in the church, you know, that type of like, hey, you know, those screen door on a submarine, brother, you know, type of stuff. But, and so I try to steer away from that very much, right? Like, so the true fact of it is, faith doesn't make things go away. It just gives you the ability to stand in them. Do you know what I mean? And so before you found God, before you found what I believed the final ultimate answer, if I'm that guy who doesn't have Jesus but does have baggage, what do you say to this guy? You know, because there's some very practical stuff, right?
Absolutely. So I didn't necessarily, like, my parents never took me to church. Like, I went to church on a school bus. Like, I was forced to go because the guy that drove the church bus, we would be at the apartment complex raising hell, and he'd look at us and say, get the hell in the bus, you're going to church. And he would, like, basically kidnap us to go to church. So, you know, so that was like my really only like church involvement. So I didn't grow up with, you know, silver spoon in my mouth. I didn't grow up with, you know, Jesus, and I didn't grow up with a Bible in my face. You know, I was living life, man. I was in the thick of life, and I was kind of in survival mode from 4 years old on till, you know, I didn't meet Jesus until I turned 17. And, I think God played a lot of what was going on in my life before that. But for the person that's not faithful, for the person that doesn't believe anything, like, you know, I believe that if you see life as like a journey, and I'm not going on some Chinese proverb, whatever you want to call it, you got to look at the thing that you went through, and it depends on your way of thinking. Do you either break it down and analyze it? And if you do you overanalyze it and you make it bigger than what it was? Or do you break it down, understand that you went through it, and then learn what way you can come through it that's not going to have a negative impact on you yourself? That would be my way of telling someone who doesn't have like a faith-based kind of way of going about life. You know, break it down, analyze it, you know, reflect on it to what you can handle, break it down, and don't go and read between the lines. Just see it for what it is. Understand. What's that? Well, yeah, just see it black and white. You know, if you were abused as a child, just say, hey, look, my father, he abused me in whatever way he abused you, whatever. Was it something I wanted to go through? Absolutely not. Did I understand what I was going through? No. Did it have an impact on my life? Yes. Okay.
Right.
That's the
simple step, right? Yeah. So
that's the simple step. It, right? Break it down.
So Dave has put together these things where we talk about this. It's so important to spend time in a journal, spend time reflecting, spend time just calling it what it is. If you don't need to tack on the cursive, you don't need to carry the extra weight. This is what happened. I was young. I didn't care much for it. I'm here now. I won't repeat the same thing. You know, disassociate from the person you were then, because you can't be the same person 10 years later. Yeah. Unless you really, really try. Like, you're holding on to the past to the point that you haven't grown, you know. And it's in every relationship, even relationship with yourself or relationship with your wife. If you're the same person 10 years later, you're doing something wrong. You know what I mean? So that's good, man.
It is. It's being completely transparent, completely raw. Like, that's the basis of all of this. Calling shit for what it is.
This version of you, and it had been working great back in December. I know it's January now, but December Preston is not good enough for what January Preston needs. You know, this week Fred is not good enough for next week Fred needs. So I need to spend these days that I get, if I get them, putting myself in position to be that guy. If that means waking up and running, if that means journaling, if that means forgiving myself, if that means...
Something to add to what you're saying too. When I was going through therapy later on in life, and I'm not going to go on a tangent on this, but the biggest thing that I learned was, you know, don't overwhelm yourself, because I was told to journal. I was told to meditate. I was told to, you know, run. I was told to work out. And I'm like, listen, I have a muscular condition. I can't do two of the things that you told me to do. So screw you. Right. So, and I'm a person, like, I like to get things done, and I don't like to like have 15 other things that are just stacked on top of me that I'm worrying about. And for the person that's listening, like, how do you unpack this? Unpack it, look at it for what it is, and then give yourself one step. Start off with something simple. You see this cup right here? You see this cup? My grandmother's cup. She drank out of this for the longest time ever. So I think this is the fountain of youth. She lived until she was 95 years old. She passed away this year. And when she died, I said, look, the only thing I want from her house is that cup she would always drink out of. Now, call me crazy, but, you know, hey, that's just my little superstition. Like, you know, do I want to live that long? Hell no. I've already broken all my bones. Like, I'm going to be sore. I'm not going to be able to walk. I'm going to be looking like, you know, a Walmart greeter. And no, I ain't doing that. So start out with something small. And the reason I'm showing you this cup is, as soon as you wake up in the morning, get a cup and drink it. Of water, not alcohol, not booze, not, you know, Gatorade, just water. Just get a cup of water and drink it. Make it the first thing you do in the morning. It's 15 seconds. That shouldn't be overwhelming. You would be astonished. Yeah. You know, it's just like that Navy SEAL that was talking, he did a big long speech about making your bed. You know, I don't make my bed. I don't make my bed because I was told to make my bed for, you know, 9 years of my life. And I was like, screw that. I'm not doing that. I'll leave it nice and the way I like it, you know, messy, and I'll jump in and I'll be comfortable. But, you know, he had a good point. Make your bed. Make your bed in the morning, because that's the first thing you accomplish. But for some people, for me, making my bed is too much. I can't do it. It was too much for me to handle when I was in the thick of the suffering, in the valley that I was in. That was too much for me to handle. And it wasn't until I figured out, oh gosh, okay, look, I just got to take it simple. Something simple. Like, just breathe.
Your goals.
Oh my God, breathe.
Yep. Yeah.
Surprised how much breathing actually does for people. Because some people don't know how to do it. And if you think I'm crazy, look it up.
Well, if our whole program, I mean, everything through the You Matter box is these simple steps, you know, go for a walk. Just go outside. Walk outside the front door and just walk. You don't have to run.
Sun on your skin. Sun on your skin, man. That's it.
Simple. Yeah.
That's it.
With it. This is awesome.
Start chipping away, and you start adding a little bit more that you can handle, and don't undermine yourself. Look, dude, if all you can do is get up in the morning and take some breaths and drink some water, and that's if that's all you can do in a day, you know, bravo. You didn't sit in your bed and whoop and wallow and stay in your bed all day. You did something. That's something.
We should open up the next episode with Is Preston just come out screaming like, just drink some water, go step outside for a second, go back in your bed and wallow for a minute.
Hydrate or die. Yeah.
Listen, motherfucker.
I get the knife hand out. I'll go get my campaign cover and, you know. So oh, man. Out
because you went from, like, this first episode was, hey, man, this is where I came from. This was the foundation of me. And this is, like, this is me in the thick of it and how we migrated through it. So let's do this again. We're going to do a part two.
Confess before we sign off, fellas. Today I didn't have any W's, you know. It was all L's. I didn't run. I didn't do anything. I ate stuff I shouldn't have ate. Like, we don't have it all locked in at all times. You know what I mean?
God,
it's
no.
just what it is. Like, it just wasn't a great day. I helped somebody. That was a good thing, you know. But other than that, today was just a big L for me, you know. But this was awesome, you know. So
if it encourages anybody who's either currently participating in this or is listening to this, I had a huge L today because, you know, I work a certain job. It's direct sales, but I've come to a point where I just said, I've had enough. I'm done. And I had told the lady I was working for, I was like, hey, I'm done. I don't want to do it anymore. So I quit my job today. So, you know, hey, whatever.
W. That's a W.
Is it a W? Is it a loss? I don't know, you know, but it is what it is. I've been all worked up, and I think that's another big thing too, is like, I don't want people to be misled, because the biggest discouraging thing that I ever ran into was having that person that was like, they looked like they had all of it together.
Yeah, the perfect the human.
Most, the, like, that was the most, like, I just couldn't stand it. I was like, my God, like, you're just perfect. And I can't stand it because I want to be there. And I didn't realize at the time, you know, when I was thinking this, it's just a facade. You know, nobody's got it right. You know, everybody stubs their damn toe. Come on. Everybody has a moment where they accidentally crap their pants, you know, whatever. Literally and figuratively.
That was Fred earlier today. So I probably crapped his pants.
I sharted. That's okay.
Hey, sharts happen, man, right?
I'm not going to lie. I was sick a couple weeks
ago. Oh, dude, if you think I got it all together, listen to this, man. Let me tell you something. Whew. It has not been, these past couple weeks have been hell. No, it's, you just, if I had one word to tell somebody, like, to wrap everything up about, like, my entire life, just one word, and it's my favorite word because it starts with a P and kind of sounds like Preston, but it's perseverance. You got to have perseverance in life. You just got to keep trucking, even though it sucks, like going through the storm. Just go through it, man.
I think after everything that you've been through and what you've learned is, it's my time, it's my life. And your life is going to expire. And that's one of the biggest things. It's like, every one of us on the screen right now and everybody listening, we're all going to die. We're all going to die one day.
Then people die.
Oh, so man. It's like the time that you have now, it's like you finally understand it. It's not, I'm not going to live forever. I'm going to die. So it's like you quitting your job today. You understand, you respect your time, your life. It's like, I could go through the struggles right now, and it's like, it's worth it. Because, if I keep on doing this for another 10 or 12 months, it's like, this isn't what my life is supposed to be, you know?
I was seeing the red flags, like my mental health was starting to, like, because I go into people's houses. I go into people's houses and try to sell them a product. And, you know, I'm not pushy with it. I'm very nice. And God, man, I couldn't imagine, like, if I did another one right now. Like, I'd probably rip someone's head off. And I can't afford that. You know, I got 5 kids and I don't want to go to jail the rest of my life.
So you understand your time. What I want to do is, the next episode of this, we're going to do it very soon, is unpack how you got to where you're at, though, to understand your time, to understand your life, the things that you want to teach your kids, how you got there, right? The difference between before the military, learning what you did in the military, and then where you're at now after the military. Let's unpack that. Say is Preston, man, I appreciate your time, brother. This has been awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Love a storyteller.
I've been told, man, between storytelling and selling stuff, they're like, man, you could sell ice to an Eskimo. First time I heard that, I laughed.
The funny thing is, these are the same conversations that we have as like a band of brothers together, all the time. You know, if you were to think about it, you know, when you're away with your, or even on Ellis Island, you said it earlier, you know, you were never like deployed, but you were still like stuck in a room with a bunch of guys wearing the uniform. And we talk about the same things. And I think that's what's necessary and needed in today's world.
Absolutely.
It's like this.
100%, man. And I just want to leave with this, man. Like, I had prayed. I've been praying since like February of last year. I've been praying for something to give. I needed somebody like accountability, somebody to talk to, like some brothers to talk to. And I'm really grateful for the conversation we had tonight. Like, I feel comfortable being able to, because I don't tell this to everybody. You know, it may sound like I do. I've told it 1,000 times, but I'm very selective with who I tell it to, because I don't want to waste my breath, you know, for someone who's just one ear out the other.
In the grand scheme of things, what you're saying tonight, and this is going to be on YouTube eventually, and there's going to be, let's just say, 500 people listen to it, and the rule of marketing, which I don't know shit about, but I kind of know about.
For a little bit.
People, there's going to be 50 guys that listen to this, and from those 50 guys, there's 10% of that, there's going to be 5 military member guys that listen to this, and they're going to hear your story. There's going to be 5 guys who can relate with it and 5 guys who won't take that opioid. There's, you know, one of those 5 guys who won't commit suicide. There's one of those 5 guys who won't beat the shit out of their wife. You know what I mean?
And that's what makes every bit of this worth it. I've come to learn that testimony, like your testimony. I mean, if you haven't had I talked to a therapist one time and I told him what was going on. And I just remember him looking at me and saying, "Look, man, I know you say you're depressed, you got anxiety, blah, 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 all this." And this is while I was still in. He said, "Look, man, I just need to be real straightforward with you." He said, 95, if not 99% of the guys that come in here that have these problems, they usually have like 1, maybe 2 problems, 3 at max. And he said, "You have 1, 2, 3, 4. He said, "You have 11 problems on your plate right now. I think you're doing pretty damn good." It's like, he was telling me, he's like, you know, you're doing good. Like, you've figured something out, stick with it. He wasn't prescribing me nothing. He was like, "Look, whatever you're doing, keep it up, because you're handling it pretty well." He's like, "I've had other guys with one problem that will, like, it's a nuclear implosion on them." Like,
absolutely. And the goal is to spread what we know, the things that we've lived through, in order to help those guys. That's the goal.
So I made a promise to the lady that did my psyche eval when I was getting out. I'm 100% disabled veteran. So when she did my psyche eval, I made a promise and a commitment to her. I told her, I said, I wanted to help veterans. I wanted to help veterans through anything that I was able to. And I'll be damned if I don't fulfill that promise, you know.
No, brother. Get you.
No, I appreciate you guys having me on.
Cheers to the first Marine on here. You still got crayons on your teeth?
Right here?
Yeah, right there. Yeah,
okay, I got it. You're good. Was it green? I think that was the spinach flavor. Sorry, I'm trying to eat healthy.
No, it wasn't.
That's another way to help out.
Red tastes like green. Come on, Marine. You know better.
Red is cherry. Come on, man.
There you go.
Do you even eat crayons? Come on, man.
But no, I appreciate
die if I pulled up a pack of crayons right now.
Everybody coming on here. This has been an awesome episode. We're going to continue this in part 2 with Preston. Part 2 with Preston.
Good.
And we're going to navigate how Preston went from childhood trauma into the military and then afterwards. I mean, what did we learn? There's a lot of things to learn. We're always learning. I appreciate everybody out there. I hope everybody has an awesome night.